This is Jim Salicrup, and you're listening to Superior Spider Talk.
Welcome to the Superior Spider Talk. My name is Dan Gavazdin, and I'm the editor of GrindMyReels.com.
And I'm Mark Cianacchio, the editor of the Chasing Amazing blog.
Thanks for joining us for the 27th episode of Superior Spider Talk. We hope you enjoy this podcast and that it provides an intelligent conversation between two fans and collectors as we hope to look at the Spider-Man comic universe in a little bit of a bigger picture.
Yes, Dan, and for episode 27, which looks to be our last podcast for 2013, happy holidays and happy new year to everybody. We're going to be discussing Superior Spider-Man number 24, answering some fan mail, and then discussing our brief thoughts on those 5.1 issues, those amazing Spider-Man 700.1 through 700.5.
As always, if you guys want to skip to a specific section, just use the chapter selection arrows on your player. And also, if you hear this sound, please check out your iOS device for a link to an article, video, or image to enhance your listening experience. One last thing, please be sure to leave us a review on iTunes. If you want to get us a holiday gift, the best thing that you can do is give us a review on iTunes. The show is free, after all, and all we ask from you is that you leave us a review so that we can help spread the word about our show.
Well, you could buy us comics, too.
Well, yes, you could do that, too, but I think this is a little bit easier.
Fair enough. All right, so why don't we mosey on into our conversation about Superior Spider-Man number 24.
Sounds like a lot of fun to me.
I remember when I lost my mind. There was something so pleasant about that place. Even your emotions have an echo in so much space. And when you're out there without care.
All right, Dan. So, I had some issues with Superior Spider-Man 23, but I for whatever reason, I thought 24 was much more tightly plotted and paced than the last issue. Maybe it was just a subtraction of one or two of the little subplots. Like, we didn't have any Jameson and his Spider Slayer plot in this, nor was there as much focus on Parker Industries. There was a little bit in the beginning. I just felt like everything kind of transitioned a little more smoothly for me, which made this a better issue overall for me. What about you?
Yeah, I like this issue a little bit better, but I don't really see that much of a difference from the last one. I do think that the, like, slightly less number of storylines here makes it a bit, easier to read. Although I don't know that I, like, love all of the content in it. I think the second half of this issue is really stellar. And the first half of it is just kind of okay.
Yeah, I mean, the first half, they're definitely kind of settling in, and it's a little clunky. Some of the stuff with, like, Cardiac and Flash at the beginning, and, you know, of course, having, you know, Flash has, what, hours to live, which, you know, I joked about on Chasing that, you know, I hope nobody tells Rocket, Raccoon, and Groot what's going on, because, you know, Marvel kind of spoiled itself again on that in terms of what's going to be happening with its characters, in terms of Flash being in Guardians of the Galaxy next year.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, I guess what worked for me from a narrative drama standpoint was I really appreciated the unpredictability of Otto within the symbiote. I mean, you know, we had gotten that reader question that we talked about a few episodes ago about, you know, what would Doc Ock do if he became possessed by the symbiote. And, you know, I think we both were in agreement that he would kind of go with it. But I guess to the extreme that he does in this issue was kind of, I don't want to say shocking, but I was impressed that Dan Slott and Christos Gage, the two writers on this, didn't kind of take any shortcuts. I mean, they just kind of went for the full Monty. That, you know, he's an evil bastard in this issue, and you know, I felt that really raised the tension and the drama of what was happening.
Yeah, he kind of goes full Doc Ock here. Like the Peter personality gets very pushed to the side. And I thought it was really wonderful, although I wish there was something more dramatic going on with the symbiote than him, like, stopping petty crimes like, you know, a guy who's speeding and a person who's texting while driving. I mean, I could think of several more interesting things to do with the symbiote than just stopping little petty crimes like that.
Yeah, well, he almost killed Cardiac, and I think, you know, more stuff is about to get set up in Superior 25 once the Avengers get called in, which, can I say hallelujah, somebody finally called the Avengers, as I've been saying for months now.
Yeah, can we get back to talking about Cardiac? There's something I was a little confused by in this issue, and I think it speaks to the setup of Parker Industries and how quickly that was handled. Mm. I'm a little, like, unsure of what the relationship is with Cardiac in this Dr. Wortham in this organization. Do people know that he's Cardiac? I mean, the second that, you know, stuff starts happening, he starts blasting his beta rays out of his body, and then Sajani is, like, healing him up without any questions, and she refers to his mesh suit. Do people just know that he's Cardiac now? Like, when did this become public knowledge?
That's a great question. I don't know. I mean, you're right. There's definitely something missing from the narrative here. I guess it didn't bother me so much because, you know, I'm not counting on Cardiac playing a large role in the resolution of this whole Superior arc. So
yeah,
for me, it was kind of like immaterial. But I get what you're saying. I mean,
I know. But we, like, nitpick on Aunt May acting out of character. To me, this is, you know, the first reappearance. The first thing we establish about this character is that he's operating underground and doesn't want anybody to know that he's got this dual, you know, faceted nature. And now all of a sudden he's just, like, brazenly showing off and who he is. Yeah.
Are you putting Cardiac on the level of Aunt May in terms of importance to the Spider-Man universe, Dan?
No. But I mean, yes, definitely. Yes. Definitely.
More Cardiac. Yeah. With great power comes Cardiac.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, I know you're right. You're right. I mean, if we're going to nitpick one thing, we probably should be equal opportunity nitpickers. So I completely cede your point on that one.
That being said, it's not enough to take me out of the story. It's just something I wanted to point out. Like, I felt like I still am a little murky. It speaks to a larger thing that I'm a little murky about how Parker Industries is being operated and exactly what it is. Although I feel like it's going to be very short lived. So
yeah. I mean, from the get go, I mean, it just kind of seems to be. It was a plot development used to further the decline of the character, in my opinion. I mean, you know, like he needed to have this so when everything really bottoms out, it really bottoms out.
Sure. We also got an appearance from the Goblin in this, and I think it's actually a little more interesting than we've received in the past. What did you think about the Goblin in this issue?
Yeah, I mean, like, he's finally doing something. I mean, and you know, he's doing something in a couple of different scenes, which, you know, kind of leads to another point we'll get to in a second about who might be the Goblin and some theories that we're getting out there. But you know, let's first talk about the scene with the Hobgoblin's goons, which was including it was not the Grizzly. It was a new Grizzly called the Bruin, which, you know, I don't know if I should be disappointed or even more impressed that, you know, there's someone else out there in a bear suit for the force of evil.
The idea that someone is paying a lot of money to wear a bear suit.
Yeah, well, you know, Roderick Kingsley's got to make money. But yeah, I mean, like, this, you know, rather than just kind of sitting in his lair and laughing maniacally and plotting against Spider-Man, you know, the Green Goblin's out there. He's addressing other issues of concern of his, including this war with Roderick Kingsley that sounds like it's about to go down in another issue or so. Like I said, I was just happy to see him do something else besides, you know, just kind of, you know, twirl his mustache, so to speak, and be evil.
I mean, what are we saying his plan is? That he's collecting the money from these things in order to, like, incite rancor within the Hobgoblin's ranks, or to maybe bankrupt him? Is that the idea?
I mean, I think he's just trying to goad him into a fight.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense.
I mean, I think that he's just trying to draw him out, because, I mean, Kingsley is kind of, you know, been behind the scenes now for a while. So, you know, he's it's not like he can just go out there and challenge him to a duel. So it's like, you know, let's screw with this operation and, you know, hit him where it hurts in the bank account and goad him to come out so he can, you know, kill him, convert him, or whatever the hell he's ultimately going to do with him.
Yeah. Well, he makes another really interesting turn here with Carly Cooper. What did you think about this decision?
Yeah. I mean, you know, throwing the goblin serum at her. And I actually had a continuity plot question, Dan. Maybe you can address this. I mean, is just getting the serum splashed on you enough to actually turn you into a goblin?
I think it's been proven to have worked in the – I mean, I guess in the past it's exploded on people.
Right.
And I forget how Menace turned, but I think it had to do with that she was fumbling around and managed to get it spilled on her. So I think that's within continuity. We haven't seen her turn yet necessarily, like
right,
whether she'll
right.
become. But there are those future solicits that say there will be another goblin joining the team.
Yeah.
And I imagine that's Carly Cooper's whatever goblin we're going to call her.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, you know, again, leading to who's the goblin.
Goblin, you know, cop.
Yeah, goblin cop. But, I mean, in terms of who is the green goblin, I mean, you know, not many people have access to that serum, if my memory is correct, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of like an Osborne family secret. It's kind of like the colonel and his secret recipe for chicken, right?
It's kind of a silly analogy, but okay. I'll give you that.
Okay. I mean, you know, it's the herbs and spices of madness, you know?
Yeah.
But so, okay. So do we want to get into this internet theory, Dan?
Is this our segue?
Okay. So, I mean, we have received comments both, through the podcast and then through Chasing Amazing and through Twitter. I've heard this in a lot of places. There's this theory that's kind of, I don't want to say gathering steam, but is out there that, you know, because all evidence seems to point to the Green Goblin being an Osborn, and why would Dan Slott go through all this trouble of not just saying it's Osborn from the get-go unless there was somebody new? So there are people out there who think that the Green Goblin might be Peter Parker, or Peter Parker's mind in Norman Osborn's body, some variation. Dan, you even kind of joked about this in one of our very first podcasts, right?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a joke. It was something that I legitimately thought would be a cool storytelling, you know, thing. So when people send this theory to us, I get it. Like, I get why this would be an interesting thing to see happen. Because at one point I thought, yeah, that could be kind of cool. But nothing in the story to me now bears any fruit on that being a real thing. I've long since divorced myself from that notion.
And I feel like that there's just too many things that have happened with the Goblin character and within the larger story that just disqualify it. And I feel like if you're going to sit there and say, yeah, but this or yeah, but that, you're just kind of making excuses. Like, I mean, like, you know, one of the things, you know, we talk about is in Superior 10 when, you know, the Goblin surrogates, the little vulture children, firebomb Mary Jane's nightclub. And, you know, I've heard that explained away by people who defend this theory two ways. One is, well, it's not the Goblin himself doing the action. So, you know, it's not like he's trying to hurt his one of his dear close friends, right?
Right.
And then the other one is, oh, well, he's trying to test Doc Ock to see if he'll defend Mary Jane against these people. But, like, I don't know, man. That just seems like a really big leap to, you know, have Peter, you know, no one dies Peter, inadvertently maybe kill somebody.
Yeah, let me just test out this theory I have by using my loved ones in particular as bait. Like,
right.
It doesn't make any sense to me.
Right.
It, you know, at best, it's a terrible character miscalculation on the writer's part about Peter Parker.
Right. But then there's some other things. I mean, you know, that we have, you know, the fact that I mean, there he the Goblin right now is with Carly Cooper. You know, before we even had the whole serum situation, I mean, like, you gotta believe that there's some torture going on, right? I mean, like Carly doesn't look comfortable sitting there, you know, like this has not been a pleasant experience for her to be their captive, right? So, I mean,
it's like the Spanish Inquisition from Monty Python.
Yeah,
give them the comfy chair,
cake or death. it's a stretch, and you know. I've heard two things kind of in relation to the most recent development with the serum. One is, the you know, it could be Peter because there's that issue. I think it's the last time we've seen Harry Osborn in the Danger Zone arc where Peter gets access to one. What's that?
Are you going to say the Goblin Key?
Yeah, that he gets into one of the lairs, right?
Yeah.
So he would have access, hypothetically, to Goblin Serum, which makes sense. But why is he using it on a friend, yeah. His ex-girlfriend? Like, why is he torturing her? And then there's the why wouldn't he remember that who is under the mask of Spider-Man if it's Peter's mind? And then someone said, well, maybe Peter doesn't have all his memories within Norman's brain, but that makes no sense because within the universe that Dan Slott has established with this mind swap device. Otto has his memories. Like, he's not missing his own memories, right?
And if he doesn't remember, then what's the point of doing all this in the first place? Like,
right.
It's just making excuses to justify a theory, which, you know, is a cool idea. Like, I'll give him that. It's a cool idea to see this, but I don't think that there's been a shred of evidence pointing towards this. I mean, what kind of evidence have they presented to you, Mark? Any that you find credible?
Like I said, it only becomes somewhat credible when someone really works hard at trying to explain away the implausibilities of it. Like someone saying, "Oh, well, Peter could have access to the serum because of issue 695 or whatever 697." I think that was that issue, and I was kind of like, "Yeah, I guess that could be," but. There's too much evidence that goes against it, and like I said, you know, in terms of it being
so does Max Modell.
Right, right. But in terms of it being cool or not, I agree that it could have been cool if things were developed differently with these characters. But, you know, I mean, I'm going to go on the record, Dan. I mean, you know, I mean, I guess you always got to wait and see how things play out. But if this is what the reveal is and it's Peter Parker, like, to me, that's going to be a massive betrayal of this character, like, even beyond what I felt one more day was in terms of making deals with the devil.
I agree completely.
Like that, I mean, you know, we joked last episode about, oh, you know, what would drive, I mean, we're the hardcore fans, what would drive us away? And you know, I'm not going to say I'll never buy Spider-Man again, but like that's like, who is this character? Then we're going to be returning a Spider, you know, Peter Parker to a Spider-Man series. And it's a Peter Parker that either willingly and knowingly acted evil as a force of evil, or unknowingly or out of his control, but still evil. So it's like, you know, why do I care about any of these characters anymore? You know, like then who's a hero? You know, like what's this isn't a superhero comic anymore. And then I should just go read Wolverine, you know?
And like, not to mention that we already saw Peter starting to come back anyway in issue 19. Like, this goes thematically against the whole idea of Superior Spider-Man, which is proving who, you know, is the better Spider-Man, not who is the better Green Goblin. Like, it's about, right. It's about methodology and an understanding with great power must also come great responsibility. Like, and how two different people interpret that. Like, I don't see what it's gained thematically by Peter Parker being the Green Goblin.
Yeah, I mean, we've been saying from the get-go that this whole superior status quo feels and comes across as like a referendum on what it means to be Spider-Man, you know, whether you're amazing or superior or whatever. And you know, kind of going on that, I mean, my theory has long been, I mean, I don't know if we want to totally start speculating on the end game, but like to me, the most appropriate and poetic way to resolve this is if somehow Doc Ock willingly cedes possession of Peter's body back to him. You know, like, I feel like that's kind of where this is going. You know, like, it would finally give Doc Ock that redemption that we've been talking about from the get-go. Because it's a moment that makes everybody look good in the end, to me.
I think that's the most interesting story to tell.
It's you know, how we get there is still anybody's guess. But, I mean, and there's even a scene in the most recent Superior Spider-Man team-up.
Yeah, I was just going to bring that up.
Where, like, you know, like, he trails off. Like, he's ready to go to the Avengers and turn himself in and be like, well, maybe Hank Pym or Tony Stark can ... And then, oh, there's Namor, and he's acting like Namor. So let's have a douche-off between Namor and Otto. That to me is where this is going. That to me would be the most eloquent and most interesting story. And I think putting Peter in the Goblin's body is just total shock and awe. And you know, there's a difference. I said to somebody, there's a difference between killing Peter and the shock of that and then outright making Peter a bad guy. And I, you know, and like, I still believe that Dan Slott is a really huge Spider-Man fan. And I don't see him doing that to the character. To me, that's a betrayal of the character. What's happened in Superior is not a betrayal of the character, despite what some fans say. It's not.
I agree. And I think it's especially interesting given Superior Spider-Man team-up number 8, because that's Chris Yost's final issue. Mm-hmm. And I got to think that he knows somewhat of what the end game is going to be like, or at least the path this is headed on. And right. For him to choose to write an issue about this particular topic, the giving up, the realizing that he's not as superior as he once thought, like, belies that thought is in his head somewhere. And I think that's kind of an interesting decision for him to make to tell this particular story. So I thought that was interesting. It read like an end of a arc, you know, and if, you know, we're going to get these kind of flashback issues and team-up issues with Superior Spider-Man team-up coming up. I mean, heaven forbid we get a team up in Superior Spider-Man team up.
Right.
But we're going to get these issues that seem kind of like less focused on Superior Spider-Man particularly. Like, right. If this is the end of the team up thing, maybe it also hints towards the end of the actual book as well.
Right. Agreed. All right. Why don't we jump back, though, into Superior 24, if you don't mind?
Absolutely.
Okay. So putting aside Green Goblin, we got some good stuff in this issue towards the end. Again, it seems like not the turning point, but the real point where this issue kicked into full gear was like right after he goes to see Anna Maria, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is where the issue really stepped up for me.
And to me, like, the Aunt May and Mary Jane confrontations at the end were just awesome. Like, just great dramatic storytelling, like edge of the seat stuff, right?
Yeah, what I liked about it too is how it kind of twists the perspective. You know, this is a moment where he could be exposed for not really being Peter Parker. And then the Venom suit shows up and provides the perfect scapegoat for why he's acting this way outside of him being Otto Octavius, you know?
Right.
And so even if Mary Jane catches on, she's not really going to catch on because she's going to think, oh, it's clearly the Venom symbiote that's influencing him in this way, a la the amazing Spider-Man cartoon from the 90s and Spider-Man 3, the movie. The Venom symbiote is actually affecting his personality, I actually like that interpretation of the Venom symbiote.
Well, yeah, I mean, and you can make a case, too, that the symbiote, like, has affected Flash's personality, you know? Like, I mean, you know, based on his actions in the Venom series, you know what I mean? Like, it's you know, about control and, you know, are you giving in to the symbiote's wills or your own, you know, ability to try and do good?
But my main point being that that's an addition from the 90s, I think.
Yes, no, you're right. You're absolutely right. I'm just saying, like, it's at least established in other places. It's right. Not like, you know, it's not like they tabled this idea and you know, from 20 years ago and they're just now rehashing it, you know, like it's been consistent with, yeah, for, like you said, since the 90s.
I know that you love this and I love this too. The giant reveal to Mary Jane where he just is just shifting into his Venom costume.
Oh, that was great, man. And like, to me, this is like Ramos at his best visually. I mean, it's a terrifying image to me. And I loved, like, MJ cowering. It brought me back to that the opening splash page on ASM 300, which is, you know, MJ kind of cowering in the corner as Venom's shadow comes up around her, and it's a terrifying image. It's great. I mean, this is what you like. There's just such a sense of like everything just running out of control right now. That's what I want out of this comic right now, you know?
Yeah, I really loved Peter's interactions with Aunt May and Jameson Sr. The way Ramos drew his like unhinged face is really creepy and made that scene feel really dangerous as he's almost attacking Aunt May. And you realize, like, this is definitely not the guy. Like, you know, when Ock is not getting his way, forget his care for even Aunt May. He's going to do whatever it takes in order to, like, you know. And I think we'll see what Anna Maria causes him to do. But I'm a little scared, about how infatuated he is with this character of Anna Maria.
Yeah, yeah. It's you know, it's funny. We were maybe setting up a true love kind of thing, and maybe it's going to be something much more dark and twisted than that. You know what I mean? Like you said, more infatuation, desperation. These are not good things to have in a romantic relationship, right?
Yeah, you keep talking about maybe, you know, her having her Gwen Stacy moment. And, like, I'm trying to think about how that would play out. Like, you know, the Goblin is in the warehouse fighting with Spider-Man. Like, he wouldn't need to impale himself on his own glider to die. Like, I'm pretty sure Dr. Octopus would tear him limb from limb.
I just meant Gwen Stacy moment, like from Spider-Man 3, the movie, where she just kind of smacks him in the face and moves on.
Don't you dare reference that movie. It didn't happen. It didn't happen as far as
you just did before.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
So, what I meant is Doc Ock's going to start disco dancing.
Yeah, I don't want to see that. I mean, unless it's making fun of that. I do want to talk about the characterization of Mary Jane here. Yes. I thought it was kind of refreshing to see like her finally being portrayed right. And, you know, last episode I talked about, you know, maybe Mary Jane will use this information. And you were like, I don't really know with the way that she's been characterized. But I think here they're finally getting it. They're finally getting how Mary Jane should be acting.
Yeah, she's a strong character and she's finally acting strong again and assertive, you know. I mean, even in the scene that she's cowering in fear, I mean, like, there's reason for her to. It's not because she's a woman. It's because, like, this horrific, you know, the person that she knows is possessed by this horrific monster that she knows about. You know what I mean? Like it all makes sense. And I loved her characterization here. I thought it was perfect. This is the best MJ we've had probably since Spider Island.
She even speaks for us, the listener, where she calls Carly and she's like, "Look, I need more clarification. What were you thinking, telling me that without more information?"
Yes, yes.
Proving that she is the ultimate Spidey girlfriend.
Yes. Now, you know, what do we think about the fact that the Avengers don't remember her phone number?
I don't know what is and isn't canon post One More Day, but it was funny that she still managed to have that phone number. Unless there's an Avengers hotline.
Right. You know, but no, like I said, I thought the ending of this comic was great. I'm back in the saddle. I mean, I never left the saddle, but, you know, I said last issue, I mean, I was frustrated by the character moments, but I still wanted to see where this was all going. This whole thing is just screaming Endgame to me, you know? Like, I mean, I almost wonder if there's going to be some jig being up next issue that's going to set up Goblin Nation, you know? Like, I feel like it's accelerated that far. Like, I mean, we talked about, you know, are the Avengers going to be called in and it's going to explain away why Peter is acting strange because it's the symbiote. And that's valid and probably the likely thing. But I wonder if there's going to be even a bigger reveal than that.
Yeah. I'm interested in where this story is going. There's a couple clunky things here and there. Like, I really didn't like the offhanded way that it was announced to Flash that he needs the symbiote to survive. I mean, like, that is such a tired story trope. And, like, to me, it just felt like a cheap way to increase the stakes here in this story, which I didn't think really needed to be, you know, increased that much. Like, yeah, okay, great. Now Flash needs to get it back. But, like, I was all for him getting it back in the first place to the way Peter's acting, you know?
Right. And you know, kind of as I was joking about earlier, I mean, like, you know, Marvel doesn't do itself any favors in the way it, like, announces its news. Because, I mean, you know, the resolution of that plot line has been spoiled, essentially. I mean, unless there's someone else portraying Agent Venom that's going to be in Guardians of the Galaxy in a few months. I mean, you know, like, obviously all is going to be restored. There's no drama. I mean, like, I couldn't even care less about Flash's story because I know it's going to get resolved, you know?
Like, yeah. I got to think that someone made a big, like, cross their wires there.
Yeah, well, maybe, you know? I mean, but that's all the whacker editorial department, so, I mean, who knows?
Yeah, it's weird, and I feel like Dan Slott tried to do his best to, like, mitigate it. He's just like, Flash has nowhere to go, blah, blah, blah. Maybe it's someone else under that costume. You know, it could, you know, sorry, Dan, that your story was, you know, let out of the bag like that. But, I mean, he's doing his best to kind of keep you on the edge of your street seat.
Well, you know, that's and Dan is good like that. So, all right. So as far as our Dan is concerned, what is your grade on this?
Mark, I'm going to give this a B. I really enjoyed this story, and I know you're probably going to go a bit higher than I am. But I like this issue, but I'm not really sure where this is going, like what the end game is. And that can be a good thing. You know, like I want to be surprised by where our characters get left. But what I do think is still a little unclear is what it's saying about the hero or a main character of the story. Like, you know, for an A book, I'd like to know what, you know, is going, what it says about our characters. And here it still feels like a lot of storylines coming together that, you know, the first half of this, I was like, okay, it's kind of interesting. It is A+ in the second half of this book, but I thought the beginning dragged it down a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying, but I mean, to me, the ending was so spectacular or superior or amazing or whatever your adjective is. I'm as you predicted, I'm going higher than you. I'm giving this an A-, which is, it's really only the third issue this year that I've given higher than a B+, and I liked it that much. I felt the fat that they trimmed out from the last issue just made this thing flow better for me, and even the little kind of clunky start to it, like, you know, it felt so far in the rearview mirror by the time we got to that last scene that, you know, and I'm excited for it's not a double sized, it's a giant sized issue for the special anniversary 25th issue in 2 weeks, right?
I'm really excited about that because that means we're gonna have a heck of a lot of story to tell.
Yeah, but probably it's gonna be a dollar more. So, wah wah
wah wah wah.
All right. So why don't we get into some spider mail? Well, before we get to our email, I just want to remind everybody that you can, of course, reach us at superiorspidertalk@gmail.com. If you email us there, we will read your mail on the air and answer any questions you may have or just kind of wax poetically about what beautiful sentiments you send us. So let's take this first awesome email from Brian Jacob, who found us through Reddit, because Dan, I know you love to post those things on Reddit and brave that community, right?
Yeah, I love it. You know, reddit.com/Spider-Man.
There you go. Brian Jacob was 6 when he started reading Spider-Man and now has a biracial son who is really into Miles Morales and Ultimate Spider-Man. So he wants to know, my question for you is simple. When are you guys going to get around to discussing Miles Morales and his incredible run of stories? He's a well-rounded and unique character that deserves a lot more attention than he gets. Although, given his present circumstances, I'm wondering if that might be happening soon. Anyway, your comment about Silver May, thanks to you, Dan, on that one, in episode 25 reminded me of a current development elsewhere in the Marvel Universe. Even though it's linked in name only, I was wondering if you might have some time to chat briefly about the wonderful and insanely hilarious Superior Foes of Spider-Man, which is one of the most consistently funny titles that I've ever seen. Keep up the great work. Thanks, Brian Jacob. Well, to his first point, Dan, I mean, I will let you go butt nutty on Miles Morales, but, you know, I just want to say we don't talk about it on Spider Talk because I'm a bad person and don't read the series. So you can blame me on that. But Dan, talk about how much you love Miles.
I love Miles, and I was a little reluctant at first because Peter Parker in Ultimate Spider-Man is my favorite comic character of all time.
My goodness.
And so seeing him die off and be replaced by Miles was a bit of a, you know, a heartbreak for me. But, you know, Brian Michael Bendis, I love his writing on this series. So and he has been Miles Morales is as good, if not at times better than Peter Parker was. And I'm really enjoying the way that his story has been told. It's a very like elongated tale of, you know, an origin story that's almost lasted, you know, every issue of the book. So I'm really enjoying it. And it looks like it's coming to an end, although there have been rumors about him coming into the 616 Amazing Universe. So we'll see. I don't know that I want that particularly, because I think what makes Miles interesting is his location and the people in his world that surround him and the continuing relationships from the previous Ultimate Spider-Man title. So we'll see what happens. Mark, you know, I plan on pressuring him to read the Miles Morales series eventually. And I know that Mark and I, if the series gets wrapped up, which it seems like it might be doing, although Bendis has hinted at doing a 200th issue of Ultimate Spider-Man, which my guess is that will be the end of the Ultimate Universe altogether, is the 200th issue of this book. If that comes to pass, Mark and I will be doing a like nice retrospective on Ultimate Spider-Man, so you can expect to hear more of my gushing there, and Mark's, I guess, you're okay with it.
Well, I read through the beauty that is the Marvel Unlimited app, I did read the entire Peter Parker Ultimate run, and for me, I felt like it's the front end of that series is really strong. I love the origin stuff. I mean, I'm not going to say that Ultimate Peter Parker is my favorite character, but I mean, it's a wonderful character. There are some issues in like the first 50 or so issues that are just, I think, shockingly good in terms of characterization and writing. It actually really makes me come around on Brian Michael Bendis, because, you know, I kind of know him more from the events that he gets, you know, like Age of Ultron and AVX and all those that, quite frankly, I find to be really dull and overindulgent in terms of, you know, this matters and this is the end all be all event of all. And you know, I actually read the Death of Spider-Man stuff that he did kind of out of order a couple years ago and found that I really liked it. It's just, you know, with Miles, it's, you know, those issues are waiting for me on Marvel Unlimited. I'll probably check them out and you know, hopefully in time for our retrospective episode. But no, I mean, I have kind things to say, and, you know, like, I mean, I always come back to that issue where Peter tells Mary Jane his secret, and like, that's just quite frankly one of my favorite single issues of Spider-Man, period. Like, I just, the way that story is framed and written and illustrated by Mark Bagley just blows me away.
Yeah, that might be my favorite issue of the whole series.
Yeah, I mean, but again, like I said, the first few arcs I think are wonderful. The Venom stuff, the way he changes the identity of Venom and the story there is, like, I think just amazingly tragic. So there's plenty of good things to say about Ultimate for
yeah,
me.
Yeah, and I, Brian, it's really nice to see that you have a son, you know, a biracial son who can have a hero to call his own in Miles Morales. And, you know, I would love to see the ongoing tales of Miles Morales continue. Although my constant feeling about Ultimate Spider-Man is that it's been a series beleaguered by editorial changes. And it looks like Miles might be suffering the same fate. But I hope for the best for Miles, because I think he's a great character and a great representative of the Marvel line, you know, for people who might not have a hero of their own, you know, in the Marvel universe. So I love the character, and I would be more than happy to talk about it some more in the future. So look forward to that, Brian, and all you other listeners who like the Ultimate series, because we will be discussing it. But to cover it as much as we cover the Amazing Spider-Man universe, you know, that would take a whole extra podcast, which
yeah.
don't hold your breath, because right. This is already exhausting enough.
And in terms of his question about superior foes, I mean, we touch on it every once in a while. I mean, I think Dan and I are in agreement. It's a great series. It's hilariously funny. I think we kind of answered that question and with the ultimate question. I mean, you know, we love that you love listening to us talk all the time, but you know, Dan and I have limited schedules, and you know, to do all these other connected series and ultimate universes and alternate timelines and all that it would probably require another 2 or 3 podcasts a month from us, right?
Yeah, and but just to add on to that, like Superior Foes is often at the top of my like pull pile for reading, because you're right, it is one of the funniest books I've ever read, like period. It makes me laugh out loud in a way that's probably unnatural.
Yes, and there's nothing wrong with that. So I think you know, it's like, hey, this guy, you laugh at my comic. That's what Boomerang would say to you. The real question is who I saw something on CBR recently there about the Sinister Six movie, and they were like, oh, well, what if they incorporated the Superior Foes Sinister Six? Who would play Boomerang? My suggestion was Vince Vaughn. What do you think?
I think that's kind of a great idea, actually.
Yeah, you know, like have you know, Jon Favreau direct it, and and have Vince Vaughn do Fred Myers. But the other suggestion was Charlie Day from It's Always Sunny. That's a good one too.
But yeah, that would be good. But I think Vince Vaughn is just like that kind of like bold enough that like I could see him fantasizing about being this like larger than life character. I think that could be really funny.
Yeah. So there you go. But we got another letter here, right, Dan?
Yeah, we got a comment on our Podomatic page, and which is great. We really appreciate it. But if you guys can comment on the iTunes, that really helps us out a lot more. But either way, love hearing from you guys. And we got this one that says, hey, guys, another awesome episode. I've been enjoying your podcast since the beginning of Superior Spider-Man. It's great to indulge my inner geek, and I always look forward to hearing your thoughts after I finish each issue. I particularly wanted to say how nice it was to hear you guys mention the Bechdel test in this episode, or that you meant the last episode. I'm a supporter of feminism, and I think it's always really useful to have guys talk about this in a positive light, even more so in dealing with spaces that are generally male-dominated like comics. Thanks, guys, and keep it up. Cheers, Dick and Knowles. And I wanted to bring this up because I did mention the Bechdel test, and it's something that you know, Mark and I have actually discussed a little bit about. You know, the male audience of the comic and how it handles its female characters. And, you know, I really subscribe to these kind of feminist beliefs and really want to make sure that I talk about these topics in the right way. Enough that, like, if we haven't heard from any women that listen to our show, if you are out there, I would love to hear from you. You know, just to know that audience is there. And to hear your feedback on the show if you feel like you're being served. But I do have a problem a lot with this kind of the fan space of comic books, because it often to me comes across as very misogynistic. And it's something that I'm always concerned about, and I want to make, you know, be a corrective voice in that community. So I appreciate the comment, Dick and Knowles, and that's something that's really matters to you. You know, even if there are no women listening to the show, I do think it is an important thing that men talk about the way that they talk about women and handle these women's issues.
Yeah, that's, you said it beautifully, Dan. I mean, you know, it's you know, my wife reads some comics, not actually superhero comics. She reads more like Neil Gaiman stuff and everything. But, you know, it's you know, like, I don't know, when I write something or when we talk about something, you know, I just want to make sure it's something that I wouldn't want to be embarrassed for my wife or my mother to hear me say. And, you know, that's kind of what I can add to that conversation, I guess.
Great. Well, that's all of the mail and comments that we got from you guys this week. Please make sure to send them in and go to iTunes and leave us another comment.
Excellent. All right. So why don't we kick back off with our reviews of the Point One issues, Dan?
Great.
Give my new boots on.
All right, so let's start with kind of, I guess, what I feel were almost like the main thrust of these point one issues. I mean, you know, they were promoted by one of the Marvel editors, Tom Brennan, at New York Comic Con as the best Peter Parker stories we'll ever read, which says something. But Amazing Spider-Man 700.1 and 700.2, a.k.a. that's the Spider-Man Frost story by David Morrell and Klaus Janson. Now, obviously, David was a guest here on Superior Spider Talk before this came out, so we did get a little bit of an advance peek at it. But I also feel that this was far and away the best of the point one issues. I felt that this was just very, very elegantly and beautifully written in terms of the actual text and dialogue and prose. Like, you could tell that an actual novelist wrote this. There was just kind of that, you know, that kind of organic beauty to how the words are put together that sometimes is lacking in the more bombastic comic book writing universe. It's a much more quieter story about Peter and Aunt May. And, you know, it's not so much about it. You know, if Peter is struggling with being Spider-Man, but I didn't feel it was like another Spider-Man No More story. It was much more kind of introspective and pensive than that. And, you know, like, I know these issues were kind of trumpeted as like a triumphant return of Peter Parker by Marvel, and that just says something about how they choose to market their comics. But I was very happy to have a Peter Parker story like this to read about for the first Peter Parker story I've read about in a while. I mean, not counting what's going on in Marvel Knights, which I don't even know if you classify that as a Spider-Man story.
Yeah. I don't know either.
Yeah, but what did you think about what David put together here?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of my thoughts about it are actually really informed by the conversation that we had with him. You know, the story is really eloquently told and quite beautiful, especially in the first half. I think he gave us a sneak preview of the scene where Aunt May and Peter are talking about the frost and the rose garden with Uncle Ben. And I think that's the best scene in the whole story, and one that he was obviously quite proud of, and I think rightfully so.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it kind of, to me, shows the danger of hiring someone on who doesn't really know the character particularly well, or hasn't read all of the issues. You know, the pacing of the story and the anime dialogue, like I said, are enough to elevate it to a story like worth checking out and definitely worth purchasing. But and I know that Morrell is very precious about his work, his reputation, and this particular comic that he created. And we'll talk about the problems that came to light. But in the second part of the story, it didn't do much for me because I feel like I've seen this story before. And I think if I was reading this in a vacuum, I would be really moved by it. But I feel like it's a bit of a retread. But, I mean, that being said, it's a refreshing breath of air that gets a lot of the character elements correct. Maybe not the spider sense so much. But, yeah, worth the price alone for the May-Peter conversations discussing the frost. That made it for me.
Yeah, no, I mean, I know exactly what you're saying in terms of David Morrell's familiarity with canon and whatnot. I mean, he all but admitted to us that, you know, he you know, the origin, he probably, you know, he knows more from Hollywood than from comics. I guess for me, not to make excuses for it, but I feel like Marvel really did a disservice to this story releasing it the way they did and the format they did. This should have been like an original graphic novel or something of that nature. You know what I mean? Like a one shot, or I don't know, not in a part of Amazing Spider-Man, just like its own thing, you know, cause that's what it is. It's its own thing. It's someone else's interpretation on the Spider-Man origin and relationship with his family, you know, like it doesn't fit into continuity anywhere. And that's not a bad thing. It almost felt more like a screenplay than a comic, right? I mean, it just in terms of, you know, the relationships or of with everyone are the traditional relationships. I mean, Jonah is back at the Bugle, and I mean, outside of Jonah, there's really no other characters that are in it. So I just feel like releasing it the way they did kind of takes away from it. And I think if you look at it strictly from how is the story written and how the images go with the story, which, I mean, I wouldn't say that what, you know, Klaus Janson was, you know, work was brilliant on this, but like, I felt it really went with the mood of what Morell's script had, you know what I mean? So that's, I guess that's why this resonated a little more with me, because I just kind of like, I put aside how it was released and just kind of looked at it as a story independent of anything else.
Yeah, and I don't want to say I didn't enjoy this. I really did. Janson's art has never been a favorite of mine. He's always felt like kind of like a less assured Romita Jr. Like, and maybe that comes from his work with Romita Jr. for such a long period of time. And I think in the second part of the story, the work seems a little more rushed than the first part of the story, which could be because he was, you know, working on the first part a while and then kind of pumped out the second part of it, like Morell seemed to have implied. But I do like, I agree with you. I think it matches the writing quite well. He doesn't have the kinetic, like, energy of something like Romita, or not Romita, like Humberto Ramos's work does, like, even in its just layouts and stuff. But I think that works for the kind of bitter cold of the story.
Yeah. And obviously you referred to it a little earlier. I mean, you know, the second part famously had some editing issues. My understanding, you know, David initially put something on Facebook, and I think David himself kind of backtracked it off it a little bit, you know, that the quote unquote terrible version of his story was published. It sounds like it was a case of, and you know, you still, I guess, can shake your head about how this happens in this day and age, that the wrong version of the story got sent to the printer. The wrong file. So there were some typos in there, and then there were some things that were put in that David asked to be removed that weren't, including like a joke about Cap, you know, there was like that token Spider-Man joke, you know, oh, I bet, you know, XYZ hero here doesn't have days like these, that they kind of slid in there, which, I mean, it was a bit of a clash with the tone of the story, but I didn't find it offensive.
Yeah, no, it's a classic Spider-Man joke. And to be honest, you know, the story I think needed, could use a little levity. So like,
yeah,
I mean, much levity, but that was, I thought it was a fine moment to get like readers back into the gear of the issue.
I mean, what actually kind of struck me as funny is, you know, and I don't think this was something that David had a complaint with, but to me, like the scene, the snowball fight scene with all the villains, which was kind of, I guess, like a dream sequence, that to me felt more out of tone, you know, away from the tone than the Captain America joke.
Yeah, I agree. And, I think either way it needed to be developed more if they were going to do that, like maybe a slow appearance of these characters or set up a real world like analog for that. It just kind of came out of nowhere to me. And it's great if it's like a symbol or something like that, but like the kind of like hallucinogenic like imagery like that was, I think, was trying to, you know, portray, maybe not hallucinogen, but like the kind of dream like stuff, I don't think it really is supported by this kind of story.
Right, but then it led directly to the climax, which was, you know, Peter with May and saving May, and then May in turn being like, now you need to rest, and then, you know, and Uncle Ben kind of showing up at the end thanking him, and that to me kind of got back to the emotional timber of the first part of this story. So it worked for me. It kind of brought it all back home.
Yeah, I agree. Mark, what did you think overall in terms of a grade here?
I'll give this an A-. I mean, I was almost thinking A after the first part, but I mean, you know, like you said, there were elements of the second half that didn't click as well. So split the difference, A-.
Yeah, I'm giving this one a B+. I think the first half would have gotten an A from me, but the second half didn't really like surprise me or pay off in a way that, you know, I think it was tonally correct, you know, and it concluded the story in the way that I expected it would conclude it. But I was kind of hoping like to be like, I think the best endings to things are ones where you're like kind of surprised by the way that it ended, but also in the back of your mind, you know, that there's no other way that it could have ended otherwise. And this one was like, okay, like it's a classic storytelling, you know, idea, the kind of hero of a thousand faces and all that stuff. And that was fine, but I was kind of hoping to get a little bit of X factor there. And I think the snowball fight scene could have been that chance to go a little bit further into the X factor, but it just didn't really quite work for me.
Yeah, that's totally fair, Dan. All right, so why don't we talk about 700.3 and 700.4, which was the two-part Black Lodge and some assorted B stories. Okay, for me, I found Black Lodge. We'll treat the B story separately if we can. Black Lodge was totally acceptable comic book storytelling for me. Joe Casey wrote it. Joe Casey has certainly been around the comic book industry for years. It's not like he's a new up and comer or anything. But like, you know, reading his writing, I was kind of like, I could see this guy writing Spider-Man, you know, like it felt like he belonged with the character. There was some humor. It was an interesting setup and premise, and a very kind of like only the hero Spider-Man would find himself in a situation like this in terms of being in this underground secretive hospital for supervillains. And he's burnt beyond recognition during a fight with Firebrand, who, you know, certainly is not a Spider-Man villain I think about, but whatever. But you know, he's both getting treated, but then kind of has to find his way out in a way that doesn't, tip his hand and reveal his identity to these people. It just felt very natural, a natural Spider-Man story to me. I mean, it wasn't great, but it wasn't a top 10 story for me. But like if this story showed up in the middle of Brand New Day, which is kind of where I place it, because there's that scene with Shocker where he kind of talks about just fighting, you know, just having fought Spider-Man and in the subways. So I'm assuming it's that two-part Mark Waid story they're referring to. I would have been totally fine with it. What about you?
Yeah, I thought this was a fine story, and it's funny that you mentioned that you feel like it came from Brand New Day, because I would put money on that this was a Brand New Day story that just never made it to print, and it fits in right here. It was fine. I don't really see a reason for this needing to be a Spider-Man story, but I did appreciate the return of Peter Parker's humor in this story a lot. And I thought the art was nice too, with some really wonderful coloring in it. So that was fun to read to me. I do call into question, though, the Spider-Man's healing abilities, though.
Yeah, he's not Wolverine, and this kind of I understand exactly what you're saying. Here's my justification of it, which might be me maybe giving too much service to a legitimate plot hole here. You know, we do know that Spider-Man does have some healing factor, and if you combine that with clearly the hospital staff that is very good at resurrecting villains, maybe together that would be enough to heal Spider-Man despite the very terrible burns he experienced. I mean, I know he probably should have just been dead, but, you know, suspension of disbelief and all that.
Yeah, and I was able to suspend my disbelief for the same reason, but, you know, at the same time, it's like he takes his mask off at the end and it's like totally perfectly fine, and he's like, yeah, that surgeon was really good. Like, really? Like, are we to believe that Spider-Man has got plastic surgery all over his face or something?
Right.
I don't know. Like, it's comic books. I'll give it the benefit of the doubt, but I.
What did you think of the Black Lodge itself? Like the premise of Black Lodge.
I liked it.
Like, I'm shocked that hasn't been done before.
Yeah. I like this idea of this roaming hospital. I mean, I always thought everybody was going to the same night nurse or whatever. That character is that they all go to. And we saw that, what was the issue where Spider-Man started beating up another character when they were going to go see the night nurse?
Oh,
like Paladin. He was beating up Paladin. I don't know when that was, but at some point, Spider-Man was beating up Paladin back in right before the Superior Spider-Man era. And I thought all the villains and heroes went to the same place. But, you know, this makes a lot of sense to me. Although I always question things like the bad guys perceiving themselves as the bad guys.
Right.
Per se. Like, it kind of creates a dichotomy that I don't necessarily know is real in the real world. But whatever, that's fine. You know, I like to think that they're like this underground army of people that think that they, like, are owed by the world, like, some money. I don't know.
Right, right. No, that makes sense. Although, I mean, I will say, of all the bad guys featured, I kind of appreciated that Shocker was back to being, like, not A-list villain, but, you know, he wasn't the cowardly lion that he is in Superior Foes.
Yeah, and I kind of liked his new costume, too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, like, he does back out of the fight in the second part, but I don't feel it was out of cowardice as much as, like, hey, man, not my problem, you know, kind of, you know, cavalier villain attitude.
But I could see where that would be, you know, considered cowardice by some people. So when I was reading that, I actually was like, oh, look at this, like, Superior Foes. Like, I mean, I know that this story was probably written years before Superior Foes was, but, like, I was like, oh, look at that. Like,
yes.
Maybe that is a kernel of where this came from. I don't know. I'm probably grasping at straws here, but that was immediately what my thought was.
Yeah, yeah. And I will say, like, just it's a minor plot point, but I did like the fact that the doctors, even after they found out who was in under the bandages, continue. You know, they didn't regret treating him because they're like, this is what we do. We're doctors. And it like, to me, like, that kind of set up a real world situation that, you know, the oath that doctors have. And I'm glad that they didn't deviate from that. Like, you know, like I felt like that kept the drama for Spider-Man and how he was going to get out of the situation a little more realistic, because, you know, if you had doctors then, like, threaten, you know, saying that they were going to inject poison into his IV or something, I mean, then it, you know, if he, you know, when he inevitably escapes, it kind of takes away all plausibility, because if he's got that many factors working against him, he's not realistically going to survive it.
Yeah, and I agree with you, and I can't tell you how refreshing it was to see Spider-Man save the villains as the hospital was blowing up. I was,
yes,
like, all right, here's the character I like.
Exactly, exactly. No, it was a really quality story, in my opinion. What about those B stories, Dan?
Oh my God!
So terrible.
We have the Black Cat story here, and I would give you a synopsis of what's going on.
But what was it?
If I could tell you, I don't know what the hell happened in this story. I have no idea who these characters are or why I should care. Like, what happened? Did you understand this, Mark?
No, I mean, it's she's checking in on an art heist and some scrappy kid shows up, I guess. It's Emma Rios on doing the art, which I love Emma Rios. I mean, I've kind of had a love affair with her ever since Cloak and Dagger, the Spider Island mini.
Yeah, me too.
So it was like, I kind of like opened it up. It's like, hey, well, great, Emma Rios doing Black Cat. And then it's like, ooh, what the hell is this story? So no, I don't think it's worth a synopsis, because I don't think that, you know, the creative team put much thought into the synopsis. So
yeah, I just didn't get it. It felt like a writer who like thought he had a story here and didn't realize the disconnect that it would create with his audience.
Yeah.
I don't know. And Emma Rios, like, I do feel like Cloak and Dagger got to be this way towards the end. It was a little narratively confusing.
Yeah.
And I wonder if just her loose pencil work, like, you know, maybe assists in creating a muddled story. As much as I love it, I wonder if, like, maybe the art is also a contributing factor here. Although, this story, I mean, it was so short and so, not like, just nothing.
Yeah, no, agreed. And then in terms of the other B story, this kind of, you know, little heavy-handed attempt to talk about bullying. I had a lot of issues with this. I mean, like, I get that this seems like a public service announcement kind of story from Marvel, and, you know, you don't want to discourage them, but I mean, the morality of the moral of the story was really not a good one. I mean, it was well, first of all, you know, we got this kid who's getting bullied, and the way he gets Spider-Man's attention is he, you know, attempts arson. And,
he doesn't just attempt; he pulls off arson.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Fair point. And Spider-Man kind of comes and, you know, reprimands him for it, but then shows up on the playground to save the day anyway. And then, like, but the way he saves the day is by being a bit of a jackass back in return, right? I mean, it's not like the kid, not Spider-Man.
I hated the morality of this story. And it's something that I like. I don't know. Did you see the movie Paranorman by any chance?
I did not, no.
Okay, this movie has this kid who's being bullied in it. And then the villain ends up being a bully who was, in fact, bullied herself. And I love that the story kind of took this kind of gray area where it made the bully into a person. Like, you get why the bully is acting that way. And one of the worst ways to, like, defend against a bully, and this is coming from someone who was bullied I was bullied my entire life. And I'm not asking for a violin here, but maybe I'll put a violin into this into this
sound,
podcast.
Sound drop. Okay.
Yeah, it'll be like our new slide whistle.
Right.
Dan tells a sad story from his past. But, like, you know, when you're a young kid and someone's bullying you, you know, you kind of perceive them as an evil person, you know?
Yeah.
And this bully, I think, was portrayed that way too. But there's a reason that people are acting that way, be it that their parents treat them badly or, you know, they have a lack of self-confidence and they're trying to make up for it in other ways. And by having the kid bully the bully back, like by fight fire with fire, you know, he just says, like, I'm smarter than you and better looking than you, and everybody laughs at the bully. It only increases the tension here, and that's how you get things like school shootings and things like that, because these kids, you know, they're pushed to a point where they're like, you know what, I'm done being bullied, I'm going to become the bully.
Right.
And this kind of story is what adds to something like that.
Right.
And it also speaks very strongly against the very nature of the lesson of Spider-Man. Like, the very first pages of Spider-Man, we have the bullies, you know, picking on Peter, and he says, I'll show them, you know? Like, he thinks he's superior. He's arrogant, you know? And so he doesn't, you know, he gets cocky and feels better than everybody else and suffers the repercussions of this. This kid, he, like, is successful for doing exactly what Spider-Man learned to not do. And then Spidey just kind of quickly reprimands him and is like, don't get too cocky, kid. But he doesn't offer him any alternative.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I'm actually really glad that you brought up the social point here about, because I was about to get on an even higher horse. I mean, let me, you know, disclaimer, I was bullied a ton too growing up. So you can cue the violin for me. But, you know, I felt fortunate that, you know, I'm a little older than Dan. So bullying, you know, bullying is bullying no matter what. But I feel like bullying is like such a different animal in today's society between the internet and what can be done to psychologically and physically torture people through that. And additionally, like, you know, like you mentioned the school shootings and teen suicide, one of the bigger issues I had was the fact that, you know, the creative team's resolution to this issue was, you know, the kid was going to, you know, solve his issues with Spider-Man. And, like, you know, like, I feel like this is a serious enough issue where if, like, you know, if you're physically fearing for your life, which I feel was treated really glibly in this issue, like, you need to go to real authorities in this world now. You know what I mean? Like, you know, like, not when, you know, kids have guns, you know, or access to guns. Like that to me was just so glib and flippant and like, oh, haha, you know, like this is a real issue. And like, this was an opportunity for Marvel to maybe address a real issue right now, like a real like life or death issue. And they just like totally dropped the ball. So
and they like half-heartedly try to with Spider-Man being like, let's figure out a way that you never have to call me again. You know, like I get that. Like I get that they're trying to be like, Spider-Man is not the answer here.
Right.
And the kid does go and apologize to the bully for lying. He's like, yeah, I lied, you know. And I get where you're going, but then Spider-Man, should not all of us have a Spider-Man to come and support us while we, you know, rally our self-esteem so that we can then lord our self-esteem over other people? Like, you know, I don't know.
I guess what I'm saying is if you're a kid in, you know, one of our listeners, if you're in high school and you're being bullied, you know, and it's really getting unbearable, I mean, to me, the better solution would be, you know, talking to an adult, talking to a parent, talking to a school administrator, talking to a social worker, whatever, to, you know, both make sure that you're coping okay and then see if there's something on a higher level that can deal with the bully. Like, and that to me is the ball that's dropped. And, you know, like I said, I mean, we're a year removed from some really heinous, well, it's not even that we're a year removed from awful things happening in schools. I mean, awful things continue to happen in schools, that, and many of them are either directly or indirectly linked to bullying. And, you know, like, just don't be glib about it. I don't know.
Like, yeah, and remember that bullies are people too. Like, it might not seem that way, but they have reasons for doing what they're doing, because they might have a terrible situation at home that's causing them to act this way. So, right. Like, yeah, and this story just speaks against all of that, I think.
All right, so let's grades on Black Lodge. I'm giving it a B-.
I'm giving it a B- as well.
Backups. I guess if we were on a star system, I guess I'd give it a half a star for trying. So what does that equate to? It's a D-.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we have Emma Rios's art, which I'm like, great, but art is only so good without a story. Yeah, I was going to give it a D, but like, this stuff is F. This is F material. This is like just shoving it in here to increase, make you pay more. So no, yeah. I'm not interested in. I would not recommend either of these stories to anyone.
All right. So let's move on to the last point one, hopefully not as emotionally torturing. Amazing Spider-Man 700.5, which was a Human Torch time travel story, and another Beast story. This one I thought was considerably better. But what were your thoughts on this, Dan?
First off, I want to acknowledge this cover. Can we?
MJ riding Spidey.
Is that MJ?
I believe so. Yeah.
I thought it was a little kid.
Oh, okay. The variant cover is much better and more appropriate in this case.
I agree, but man, like, I'm looking at it now. Yeah, you're right. It is MJ. But, like, what is going on? First off, like, Spider-Man's body, he's, like, either he's the most bulky, muscular dude on Earth, but, like, his legs, man. I hope you're looking at this, but, and viewers, look down at your podcast window, because... God, I don't know what was going on here. First off, not particularly safe for MJ, who is at best like barely hanging on to the back of Peter Parker while he's swinging through the city, who's also unmasked and like, holy moly, who is this person under the mask? I'm not even sure that I recognize this. I don't know. Mark, are you as offended as I am by this cover?
Well, offended is a strong word. it's not particularly good. It makes no sense.
The Amazing Spider Horse? What's going on here?
But I mean, I thought the cover to, like, ASM 700.2 was also way off the tone of the story, which was, you know, Spider-Man, you know, a maskless Spider-Man outside of Aunt May's window as she's coming home from food shopping. So yeah, I mean, the covers in general on these stories have not been particularly worthwhile. At least, like I said, the variant is a Spidey and Human Torch illustration, which makes sense.
Did you see the Black Cat variant?
Yes, that was also good. I actually picked up the variants on all these because my store just—I guess they're like 50-50 variants or something. My store had them all, and they normally don't, and they weren't charging more for them. So I was like, oh, I'll get the variants because it's there. Because, you know, I'm stupid. what, did you not like the Black Cat variant, or?
No, I really liked it. I thought it was really great.
Yeah, I mean, agreed.
but what, can we get back to this disco pants, Mary Jane? What is going on here?
What else is there to say, Dan? I mean, you know, that's a good...
I'm staring at a black hole, and here, okay, moving on. I'm going to have to get over this.
I don't know if you have to get over it, but, you know, it is what it is, my friend.
Peter Parker, this is like halfway through between the mutation between Peter Porker and Peter Parker. Like, what is going on here? okay, I'm done.
Do you promise?
I can't promise.
Okay. So as for the story...
there's a story here? I couldn't open the cover. I was.
I mean, it's a really simple Spider-Man Human Torch team up where Human Torch shows up, talks about the thing from the future with a beard, which I thought was a funny touch. We all have beards in the future, except for Sue. Well, of course not. Well, you don't know. this was a total filler issue. I could see this being an annual. But with that said, I guess I'm a sucker for the Spider-Man Fantastic Four dynamic. And this was like, this felt like a very traditional story. I'm assuming this takes place pre-death of Johnny Storm.
Yeah, this feels like another Brand New Day, plug-in story.
You're right. Although they all know his identity. So then that would kind of place it after that arc that Dan Slott did.
Ah, yeah, you're right. So maybe this is like pre One More Day. Like this is like, I mean, the story could be any time, you know.
Right, right.
But like, yeah, they do. Is Mary Jane? She's living in an apartment. She's not in Avengers Tower. So
yeah. So it's post breakup. I love that we get to like sit here and like really obsess over this.
Who knows where this is taking place? Yeah,
it was a funny script. I felt I liked the patter of it. Like I felt it was very almost sitcom-y in terms of, you know, the thing shows up. I'm here. You know, it's kind of like, you know, the narrative and the actual dialogue kind of like play off each other a lot. There were some good jokes. From a sheer technicality standpoint, I felt like the Fantastic Four and Peter himself is like really kind of cavalier about his identity in this, like oh, we're flying outside your apartment in our little hovercraft, and you know, like they just keep referring to him as Peter even when he's in costume, which kind of felt odd to me.
Peter's just lying in bed in his Spider-Man costume with the windows open.
Right. Yeah, that just seemed a little odd to me. I thought MJ was used well here. I mean, you know, like, oh, you know, so you got something in my apartment that's going to end the world. And he's like, well, we'll end the world no matter where it is. She's like, yeah, but it's in my apartment. Again, it was kind of like the patter of the script.
Yeah, I love the little notes like when Johnny Storm comes flying into his apartment and everything gets caught on fire.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I was reading it and I was like, that is a big flame to be contained indoors. And then they addressed it on the next page. And I was like, oh, okay, that's funny.
Yeah, and like, oh, we just opened a portal in MJ's apartment. I mean, it's nothing consequential. This is far from the greatest Peter Parker stories we'll ever read. But like, if this was like a one-shot transition issue between larger arcs in the Amazing Spider-Man continuity, I would totally not be offended by it.
Yeah.
So other than that, I wasn't totally blown away with Sean Chen's MJ. Like, I felt like her facial features on the close-ups were a little too loose. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Or am I being too nitpicky here?
I know you were saying this, and I read through it again. I don't know if I agree with you. I kind of liked – I mean, it's a straight Romita ripoff.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's fine. Yeah, I mean, there's a little loose. There's not a lot of detail there. Maybe they're trying to make her look younger, but it's fine. I like the kind of grounded nature – of the visuals in this, you know, they're very, I mean, it's like a sitcom, like you said, like it's very much like not much super heroics going on, just kind of people talking. And I thought it was rendered pretty well. Although not like amazing. It's fine. It's a bunch of talking heads.
Yeah. And the final reveal was funny. I mean, the fact that, you know, it was all a joke played by Thing in the future. And then like Human Torch from the future tries to get Thing back, and Thing is like, oh, I already beat you to the punch. And it's like, oh, and then like maybe one day we'll use the time travel machine for something useful, you know? Like, it was like, oh, you know, ha, 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 let's all laugh.
Yeah, I don't know if I needed to read as many pages as I did to get to that laugh. Like, I don't know that it was worth it, but like, it was fine.
Yep. And then the B story was this story about this kid who was shot and eventually died while trying to save Spider-Man. I mean, this definitely kind of has a kid who collects Spider-Man vibe to it. I mean, without Roger Stern's amazing writing behind it. Yeah, it definitely has that vibe to it. At least it doesn't have like that soul-sucking gut punch that kid who collects has at the end. We kind of know early on that this kid's days are numbered, and you know, the bigger reveal is this kind of what would Spider-Man do comic that he was writing. And, you know, the story emotionally lands. I liked it. You know, it was effective for what it was trying to do.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the art style here, especially when you get the change up in the second half or the last page where it's all the kids' drawings. I thought were really like cute and appropriate, and the final image of them standing together. You know, it hit me emotionally. It's a little too easy. Like, it's too emotionally easy. Like killing a kid and making you feel bad. But, you know, I thought it was handled really, like, in a classy way. And, you know, in terms of backups go, this is the kind of thing I would expect to see in a backup. A quick, emotionally easy comic that has some nice artwork.
And especially in comparison to earlier in this issue. Earlier in this series with these other B stories, you know, like the bullying one we just discussed. You know, like this to me was a lot more grounded and less heavy hand. I mean, even like you said, even with being emotionally easy, I found it less heavy handed and stupid, for lack of a better word, than the other kid related B story we got.
Yeah, I agree.
Why don't we do some grades? Why don't we split this up? The Torch story and the Kid story. What do you think, Dan?
Sure, I gave the Torch story a C+. It's an okay thing. It's fine. It's kind of funny. It's a C+.
Yeah, I originally I was thinking B. I think I'm going to do B-. I'm a sucker for the Spider-Man Human Torch dynamic, but I mean, you know, this. I gave Black Lodge a B-, and I would put this on level of Black Lodge.
Yeah, I like Black Lodge a little bit more.
Okay.
What about the kid? What did you think?
B.
Yep, solid. I'm right there with you. B. It's a solid B.
Yep. Cool. All right. So why don't we bring it on home, Dan boy?
Great. Of course, you guys can find all of our Superior Spider Talk podcasts at superiorspidertalk.podomatic.com or find us on iTunes by searching for Superior Spider Talk. And if you guys do, please make sure you leave a rating. It would be a great Christmas present. Mark seems to be wanting some comics. And a comment, you know, you can let us know how we're doing, and we'll read it on the air. If you have any opinions on these comics or any questions on them, please email them to us at superiorspidertalk@gmail.com, and we will address and read them on the air like we did today.
Yes, and when you're not busy buying me presents, be sure to check our Facebook page at facebook.com/superiorspidertalk, because it's a great place to keep in touch with us between shows, as we often put up articles that we've written and other breaking news about the Spider-Man universe, how to get in touch with us. We actually just recently surpassed 100 likes on our Facebook page, and as a thank you to you, we put a digital download code for the first part of Spider-Man Frost. So, you know, keep in touch with our Facebook page, because who knows what we might be giving you people as a gift.
There are more codes where those came from, so yes. Keep checking back.
Yeah, absolutely, except there's no codes for Scarlet Spider 25, despite it being a $3.99 comic.
Grr.
Dan, where can we find you on the internet?
Of course, you can always find me on Twitter at Dan Gavazdin, or on my website, dangavazdin.com, or you can read my movie review website, grindmyreels.com, where this week I wrote up a nice thank you piece to Peter O'Toole, who passed away this week at the age of 82, and his performance in Lawrence of Arabia, I can definitively say, changed my life and made me pursue filmmaking as a career. So I wrote a nice little thank you piece to him. So if you're interested in what I had to say, you can go to grindmyreels.com. What about you, Mark?
Well, I was going to say, Dan, I'm going to go check that out the second I get off the internets with you, because I'd love to read that, because I know how much Peter O'Toole meant to you.
Great.
Yeah, as for me, you can find me at chasingamazingblog.com. We have some Christmassy themed posts coming up during the week of Christmas, and then look for around New Year's a year in review article that will be up on Chasing Amazing. And other than that, we'll be doing the usual stuff, you know, new issues, classic issues, et cetera, et cetera. You can find me on Twitter at ChasingASMBlog. Find me on Facebook at facebook.com/ChasingAmazing. And then for non-chasing related stuff, you can find me on the Comics Should Be Good blog at the Gimmick or Good column, which is my 90s comic book column.
Mark, this week I didn't bump into anyone that knew you, but I wanted to use this time to kind of thank our listeners for supporting us through not our full first year of the podcast, but through 2013. It's been really a fun time. And without your guys' support, you know, we wouldn't be doing what we were doing and having all the fun that Mark and I have been having.
You know, Dan, I was really thinking that you were going to talk about being in the Museum of Natural History around Christmas and having a dinosaur man show up and ruin your trip to the museum.
That would have been really funny, Mark, but I don't like to joke around.
Oh, sorry. No, I echo Dan's sentiments. This has been great. I mean, Dan, I'd like to thank you for you know, bringing this together and doing what you do every time we do one of these episodes. I mean, you know, I just sit here and babble, and Dan is the one who puts it all together. There would be no Superior Spider Talk without Dan's tireless efforts in putting this all together and producing. And you know, like this podcast has been wonderful. It's great getting in touch with fans the way we've been able to, and to hear from you guys with your emails and your tweets and your rumors on you know, and everything. Just keep doing it. I love it. Even when we disagree with you, we love it. So please, you know, thank you. And we really do wish everyone a really happy and safe holiday.
Yeah. So happy holidays, everybody. And, Mark, We have a particular person we like to call out to on the holidays.
Yeah, you know, the holiday season, it's kind of a pensive time. You know, I think about the frost and you know, somebody working in the garden. That person would be my Uncle Ben, who would, of course, remind you all, with great podcasts must also come Superior Spider Talk. And, of course, have a happy new year.